Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to issue 127 of The Bugle. That's a lot of bugles. That is a lot of bugles. Audio newspaper for a visual world with me, Andy Zoltzman, in the London suburb of Wapping, so named after the noise William Shakespeare made on this very site on his stag do over 400 years ago when he woke up in a drunken fog to find that his buddies had put him in a catapult and were just about to fling him across the Thames for a joke. He said, "Wah, ping!" And in New York City's Manhattan District, so-called, because in the first ever game of charades ever played there, it was a gesture of peace between the local indigenous population and the Dutch back in 1626, I think it was. The Dutch big cheese Peter Minuit kicked off by trying to do the Pope. The locals, who did not know anything of Popes, guessed man hat on, and the name stuck. Anyway, in what should have been called Pope Urban the Eighth Island, it's the self-styled John Oliver of comedy. John Oliver!
Andy, I was this close to walking out there.
Which bit?
This nearly never got going, the Bugle.
Which bit?
It's bold. It is bold to do puns before I've even started talking,
you know,
Andy.
You know, I just like to like just smooth the ground for you, John, to make your path easier.
Well, hello, Andy. Hello, Buglers. He's a lot of bugles, Andy. What would the collective noun be for, you know, a bunch of bugles?
A bunch of bugles?
Yeah.
I don't know.
A shitstorm of bugles?
A digestion of bugles.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Well, Andy, talking of digestion, yep. Tony Blair was a guest on The Daily Show this week. And, you know, the link there being he digests things.
Yep. He sure does.
He's just like us. He's flesh and bone.
Yep.
And I spent part of the day helping prepare for the interview, which was a thoroughly unedifying experience. It's like trying to swat a fly with your hand, interviewing Tony Blair. There's very little chance you'll make any contact with the fly. And even if you do, the fly will just happily bounce off and keep incessantly buzzing around and go and leave traces of excrement on everything that it touches. That's how it feels, preparing for a Tony Blair interview.
And how was he? Did he get to meet you?
I avoided him this time, Andy, after the absolutely catastrophic meeting last time. Yeah, I think it's best if Anthony and I keep a wide berth.
And was he funny on the show?
No, he wasn't funny, Andy. He was...
Was he racked by guilt?
He didn't seem to be overthinking that, Andy.
Right, okay.
No, he was quite hawkish as to whether Iran should be bombed. So he's doubling down very much...
Did you just point to it on a map, saying, "Look, there it is. It's f***ing massive. It is f***ing massive." Sorry, viewers. Chris, you were away last week.
Yeah, 14
f***ing two c***s we had.
Yeah,
it's true.
Yep, we made Ped work for his dollar. So this is the Bugle for the week, beginning the Monday, the 20th September 2010, recording on the 17th of September, meaning that, according to Wikipedia, it is 2,490 years to the second since Leonidas and his 300 Spartans stuck one on the Persians and changed the course of history. John, if those oiled-up, muscled hunks hadn't seemed off the perfumed effeminacies from Persia at the Battle of Thermopylae, meaning Hotgates Thermopylae, which incidentally was Chris's nickname at school. Sorry, but anyway, we'd have all been speaking Persian if it wasn't for that, and I am going for my historical detail from the film 300 rather than the writings of Herodotus there. But, it's been a while since me and Herodotus communed.
Top story this week, Popapalooza 2010. And well, the Pope is on a whirlwind four-day tour of the UK as we speak, and he's playing all his greatest hits. And he's been a set list of classics like God Bless You and Peace Be Upon You, as well as sing-along lighters in the air favourites such as I Was Not Personally Aware of Any Institutionalised Child Abuse in the Church, and encores like, No, You Absolutely Cannot Wear Condoms. He knows what his fans have come for, and he's not going to let them leave disappointed or indeed guilt-free.
That's right. That is correct, John. The earthly representative of Santa Claus is in London this as I speak, John. In fact, listen very carefully. I'll just point my microphone in the air a bit. Can you hear it? It's a bit popey. He's about 10 miles away, I think. He's in Twickenham, isn't he, at the moment? Coming into central London. Just feel that bit of holiness coursing across the...
Well, you should feel a kind of very violent burning sensation on your forehead.
Yep, yep.
This is a major visit, though. What's the atmosphere like over there, Andy?
Well, I've not really left the house, John, for fear of being cast into a pit of eternal damnation by mere proximity to the magic man himself.
Magic man.
But only the second reigning pope to visit these shores, John. Second, they really won't let that whole splitting off the Anglican Church thing go, will they?
No, it's the first visit by a pope since 1982, when Pope John Paul II nearly impregnated the runway at Heathrow Airport. The man loved runways, Andy. What started with just a peck on the tarmac could so quickly escalate into some very vigorous dry humping. It is an amazing visit, this. I believe it is the first time the royal family has invited the pontiff for an official state visit in 5 centuries. It's pretty impressive. There was a great bit of footage of the Pope just before he left Italy, on board an Air Italia plane, speaking on a microphone, very much looking like he was doing the in-flight safety announcement himself. Please look to your left and to your right to locate your nearest safety doors. Now, look towards me and realise that you're on a plane with the f***ing Pope and there is no way that God is going to let this plane crash. Please relax and enjoy your flight.
Well, it's understandable that the royal family have not invited the Pope, John. This dates back to when Henry VIII thought that Clement VII was looking at Anne Boleyn in a unholily lustful manner. So it's understandable they've been a bit reluctant to open that door again.
That's right. It goes all the way back to Henry VIII, first saying to his wives, "It's not you, it's me. I think we should try some time apart." And when I say we, I mean your head and your body. So any visit like this requires a very deft diplomatic touch with the inherent tensions available. Sadly, the visit got off to a bad start before it had even begun, when a senior papal advisor said that arriving at Heathrow Airport is like entering a third world country. Presumably, that is not a compliment, Andy. He didn't mean one of those state-of-the-art third world airports with giant plasma screen departure boards, elegant water features, indoor monorails and 3-storey Cinnabons.
Cinnabons?
Cinnabons, Andy.
What are they?
They're a fixture of American airports.
Cinnabons?
You can get a cinnamon roll, cinnamon bun.
Oh, right, I see. I thought it was like some Jewish thing.
No,
a cross between a synagogue and a James Bond theme park.
Well, I would patent that very quickly, Andy.
Well, I thought when he said that, he was actually...
Not open Saturdays.
I thought he was being pretty complimentary. Because, I haven't travelled at Heathrow for a few years now, but when I last travelled there, it wasn't like the third world, John. It was like the seventh circle of hell. So I think describing it as a third world suggests they've made some major improvements.
The cardinal who made these comments was apparently unable to make the trip to the UK after he was suddenly taken ill. And I'm guessing that the Vatican doctor was instructed to make that diagnosis to him. Cardinal, how do you feel? I'm actually feeling fine. No, you're not. You're feeling like you don't want to get on a plane. No, I'm very much looking forward to the trip. No, you're not. You're coming down with a nasty case of shut your f***ing mouth. The best thing you can do is drink lots of fluids, stay exactly where you are for the next 4 days, and shut your f***ing mouth. But instead of doing that, the cardinal doubled down on his comments, claiming that he was actually referring to Britain's immigrants. Oh, that's much better. Everybody calm down. This is a huge misunderstanding. I was just being racist. Are we good now?
Well, despite this, 70,000 people apparently turned up to the Mass in Glasgow yesterday, John. That's the biggest live audience any touring character act has drawn in Britain for years. But still well down on the 1982 Pope, who was a much, much better Pope. Much for my money, He had that X factor.
Yeah.
He was like the Jimi Hendrix of Catholicism.
By X factor, do you mean cross?
Oh, yeah, that's what they call it, isn't it?
Yeah.
But his audience has gone down since 1982, clearly. And it shows if you don't keep up your touring momentum, you know, you've got to keep coming back and
building up
the crowd.
You're right.
Doesn't help when he basically did exactly the same material as John Paul II did in 1982. But I know the crowd at big outdoor gigs do want to hear the old favourites, as you say, but he's got to freshen it up. You have to freshen it up.
It's hard to know what was really going on with these cardinals' comments, Andy. Is the Vatican really that stupid? Well, that is entirely possible. In fact, it's borderline probable. Or are they, in fact, diabolical geniuses? Is this just a clever cup-and-ball distraction trick to try and make people in Britain forget that they're actually supposed to be angry about child abuse scandals? That
there was you shouldn't use cupping balls as
that's true.
In a sentence like that. So.
That's, yeah, I'll take that back. There was no way, though, that the Queen, the big Q, Andy, Q units, there was no way she was going to let that kind of comment go unchallenged. So she broke out some of the Windsor family's trademark passive aggression, apparently remarking to the Pope when he arrived that he'd arrived in a rather small car. Oh, shit! Have a taste, Benny! You just got queen-slapped! She did not just talk shit about your Popemobile. That did not just happen. You just got royally served. You got put in your gold-plated place.
The interesting thing, the Popemobile has been souped up a bit for this visit. It's been fitted with satellite navigation, with directions given in a booming voice of God and in Latin. Also has wireless internet so the Pope can tweet blessings whilst driving around. And on Sunday at the famous Silverstone racetrack, Britain's top 20 Pope impersonators are going to race specially souped-up Popemobiles at speeds of up to 175 miles an hour.
Well, here's the thing. It's strange you say that, Andy, because thankfully there was at least some British subjects on TV over here who seemed to be a little more impressed with the Pope's choice of wheels. Because there was a reporter who was talking to some Scottish school kids, one of whom said to him, said to the reporter that the Popemobile goes 150 miles an hour. The reporter was stunned, partly because of the speed in question, partly because of the confidence with which the kid spewed the pseudo-fact, and I guess partly because he just didn't want to be the one to break the child's heart by telling him that's not necessarily true. Why can't we just let children have their innocence for a little longer, Andy? I remember you telling me that you'll never forget the day that your parents told you that the Pope couldn't fly, and that he didn't, in fact, come through the grill of your air conditioning unit every Easter to leave chocolate eggs to thank you for killing Jesus.
Well, I found out that he couldn't fly when I dropped him out of a window. He flapped, but he did not fly. But it has been quite a controversial visit here, John, and I did a gig last Monday for the British Humanist Association as part of their protest the Pope.
They must be thrilled about this trip.
Well, yeah, it's given them something to get out of bed in the morning for, I guess. But I will say thank you. I'm a huge fan of the British Humanist Association, particularly after one of them, and I'm fortunately I didn't get to meet him properly, gave me a bag with three packets of biscuits and a card from the British Humanist Association Buglers.
Yeah.
And
ooh, nice.
a photograph of Florence Nightingale playing cricket.
Very good.
Yeah. Almost an icon, if you will, ironically.
Very good.
But this visit has cost the British taxpayer £12 million, John. £12 million. And this has caused some controversy. I guess the correct response to that level of expenditure from the public purse in these times of straitened expenditure when firstborn babies are being drowned just to keep the benefits bill down. £12 million quid is being spent on the Pope's visit. Well, I guess the instant reaction to that is, well, it's not that much. That's 25p each. I reckon we can stomach it. I know most people think he's a bit of a weirdo, dresses up like a crackpot, but a lot of people do seem to buy into his repent, you shitbags, or you'll f***ing cop it big time when you're dead shtick. So it's not that much. I wish we'd stop whinging about every single bit of public expenditure that does not benefit us each individually directly. The greater concern is that there does appear to be a reasonable legal case that he should be arrested and tried. Not just for impersonating a police officer, he's guilty of that, although it was a police officer who'd gone undercover as the Pope, but for his role in covering up the child abuse that appears to have become rather more widespread in the Catholic Church than the teachings of Jesus Christ explicitly encourage, if I remember the Bible correctly from my school days. I guess it depends on how you interpret the words, suffer the little children. But, I mean, this is the problem with Jesus. He spoke in a weird language, and he often mumbled. And with hindsight, it would be nice to have been a bit more explicit on issues such as whether or not it's okay for priests to rape children, and whether Inquisition should use polite questioning or institutionalised torture and murder, and other stuff like that. There's just been too many misunderstandings down the years, John, and it's about time the man at the top started accepting responsibility.
It's a little hard to swallow. The only thing is, considering how wealthy the Catholic Church is, and quite how financially f***ed fucked Britain is.
But he is, does seem to be attempting to brush this issue under a carpet that is already scraping the ceiling due to centuries of stuff previously brushed under it, whilst the immortal Vatican doggy lies on top, trying to have a snooze, thinking to himself, this carpet ain't as comfy as it used to be. It keeps wriggling. Woof, woof. and the Pope, in 2001, the then Cardinal Ratzinger, named, in fact, due to his father's incredible ability to zing rats. Hey, Greyface, still scrabbling around in filth to make a living, loser! In 2001, he wrote to every bishop in the world.
Andy, that is, you're going to have to just let me have a little bit longer with that one. That's too funny to just carry on. We all need to have just a moment to let that sink in, Ratzinger. Okay, now continue.
Yeah. I mean, he's picking on an easy target, to be fair, but he did it well. So, anyway, in 2001, Ratzinger wrote to every bishop in the world, telling them that allegations of abuse must be dealt with, quote, in absolute secrecy, completely suppressed by perpetual silence.
Oh, my God.
He kept stum, John. He went popadope and hoped that the issue would punch itself out George Foreman style. Instead of carrying on chirping up irritatingly George Formby style. But it turns out the tried and tested tactic of trying to eradicate paedophile priests by ignoring them, not punishing them, and whistling loudly has not proved that successful so far. But I think we just need to let it have a bit of time.
The Pope is clearly concerned about the spiritual direction in which the UK is heading, talking about an aggressively atheist undercurrent and atheist extremists at work in the country, as if there are atheist terrorists, Andy, blowing themselves up for an afterlife paradise they do not believe exists, screaming, there is no God, and this is a futile gesture, before pressing the detonator button and yelling, see you all in the void of nothingness. But is it true, Andy? Are we really aggressively atheist as a nation now, or is Britain and religion not just slightly growing apart? Like we're in a stale marriage. You know, we have different interests now. We've changed over the years. We're not going to split up. We're just going to stay together until death do us part, just in case that whole afterlife thing has something in it. We're basically friends with hypothetical benefits.
I don't know. I think he says aggressive atheism. I think he's mixing that up with alcoholism. I think that's
It's
a language barrier thing. I think you meant to say that. That's bearing in mind that his first stop was Glasgow.
Yep.
Take that, Scotland!
You do like a wee drop!
But he's been buttering us up, though, John. He's been saying a lot of nice things about Britain. As he said, in this challenging enterprise, may Britain always maintain its respect for those traditional values and cultural expressions that more aggressive forms of secularism no longer value or even tolerate. Now,
what?
Yeah, I mean, being lectured on tolerance from a man with a slightly questionable record on dealing with child abuse, it stings a little bit, John, to be honest, as a citizen of the United Kingdom, as I still am. Do you still have the papers or not?
Yes, I do, Andy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'll f***ing use them every now and again, mate. God, it's been awfully sweary, the Bugle, recently.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is. Chris, any suggestions?
Well, maybe you just need to listen to the words of the Pope.
All right. Ooh. What did he say? Don't f***ing swear.
Right, that's now 12 f***s one today.
Oh, God.
Actually, now I've just said that, that's 13-2.
I was going to say 12 f***s one c***s. That's pretty much the Jewish attitude to the New Testament, isn't it?
Oh, Andy.
I'm going to burn in hell for that. In hell for that joke.
That's a way to make the absolutely foul truly sublime.
Oh, well, I hope you enjoyed that joke, Buglis, because I'm going to suffer eternal pain for your laughter. Well, I think, you know, we are, as he says, we are an increasingly atheist country, John. I think that's because all the evidence does suggest that if God does exist in one or more of his or her, his various forms, as advertised by the different franchises subcontracted to promote him around the world, if he does exist, and looking at the state of the world, that is looking like the biggest if since Rudyard Kipling started projecting the titles of his poems onto the night skies above Gotham City. But if he does exist, and I fully realise and acknowledge that this sentence has now spiralled both out of control and out of comprehensibility. If he does exist, then it is increasingly clear that he is regrettably f***ing shit at his job.
God's Creatures news now. And Andy, I guess God has a plan for all of us. That's, again, I guess that's certainly what the Pope would argue. And no, he has a plan for the animals too. A fairly clear plan, seeing as how he made some of them absolutely delicious.
What's his plan for me, John? Because to be honest, my career's drifting. It'd be nice if he could tell me what it is.
Well, he works in mysterious ways, Andy. tigers, though, for instance. Tigers, God seems to want to die out slowly and sadly due to mistreatment at the hands of humanity. That seems to be his heavenly plan for the proud beast. As a report's been released revealing that the cost of keeping tigers alive in the world is about $80 million per year, but only about $50 million per year is being pledged. So it's not that we don't care about tigers, we just don't care quite enough about them. We're willing to keep them alive, but struggling. It's the same attitude we have towards the welfare state. Just give vulnerable members of society fractionally enough to physically survive on, but no more. Give tigers the incentive not to become extinct, Andy, so they don't just lie around the savannah all day waiting for handouts.
Well, that's $50 million, about £30 million. I'd so suggest that the entire tiger population in the world is worth the same as a medium-caliber holding midfielder. There's about 5,000 tigers in the wild, John, so if they're getting 50 million quid a year, that means that these parasites are each earning 10 grand a year for doing absolutely nothing, just prancing around looking stripy. Yeah. That is more than Hamid Karzai gets for running Afghanistan.
Right.
I know they're always on call, and pro rata doesn't work out great, but that is still several times the average annual wage in India, where most of these bastards live.
Midterm news now, and well, the midterm elections in the US are very much on the horizon, and this week saw some very surprising results in some Republican primaries as Tea Party candidates defeated establishment figures. And this all has the effect of pushing the Republican Party further to the right and pushing it so far that it may well be approaching the city limits of Crazy Town now. Perhaps the biggest shock was in Delaware, Vice President Joe Biden's old seat, which was thought to be a shoo-in for incumbent Republican Mike Castle, until the emergence of Christine O'Donnell, who is a fundamentalist nutjob, very much from the whack job tradition. Among her many personal and policy flaws is an open and vibrant stance against masturbation, calling it ungodly. She stated that it is not enough to be abstinent with other people. You also have to be abstinent alone. The Bible says that lust in your heart is committing adultery, so you can't masturbate without lust. I'm sorry, Andy. That's simply not true. It is entirely possible to masturbate out of sheer boredom. She should spend a day in the shoes of some travelling middle-aged businessmen in bad hotels. They whittle it down from a lack of anything else to do.
So speaks a travelling businessman. I mean, if she's going to say things like this, John, she should say them without looking so damn hot.
Here's the troubling thing, though. She raised $1 million online on Wednesday. $1 million. The day after her victory. So even if her craziness is not electable, it is certainly extremely lucrative, which in turn makes it extremely electable.
Even Karl Rove has said that O'Donnell has said some, quotes, nutty things in the past. And when you're getting slammed by Rove, you know that you probably have said some nutty things in your past. She apparently condemned research into cloning of primates, saying that American scientific companies are crossbreeding humans and animals and coming up with mice with fully functioning human brains.
Oh, my God. I hope that is true.
Yep. Well, it was on the internet, John. So.
Not that she said it. I hope scientists are doing that, Andy. I very much would like to see a mouse, especially, you know, there's lots of mice running around the subway tracks here. It'd be great to have one look up and say, what are you looking at? Yeah. You do your thing, I'll do mine. Yeah. Wow.
It's a bloody train light again. I want to end it. Bugle feature section now, and cheating! Well, I talked last week about the cricket match-fixing schmozzle, which has been, I think, probably the most depressing story in the history of the human race.
And it was a blow, yeah. Andy. Yeah.
It's hard to see how our species will ever truly recover its lost innocence.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll give it a go.
But there have been other match-fixing scandals recently. In snooker, even, the former world champion John Higgins was recently found not guilty of match-fixing after a tabloid sting in which he had appeared to offer to fix bits of matches. And he was found not guilty of that. But snooker does have a bit of a history going back. Silvino Francisco, the South African snooker player, turned out to play the 1983 B&H Masters using a frozen salamander as a cue, having taken money from a dodgy betting syndicate who had bet a lot of money that someone at the 1983 B&H Masters would use a frozen salamander as a cue. I mean, he would have got away with it if the salamander hadn't thawed out and woken up under the lights. And it turns out that snakes do not like having chalky tongues, not one bit. But I guess the problem is that when 50,000 people are all suddenly betting on someone playing with a frozen salamander, alarm bells will ring. So I guess, you know, it's hard to get away with these things.
Derek Jeter, Andy, was also in trouble this week after it emerged he had faked being hit by a pitch against the Rays when the ball actually hit the end of his bat. And the response seems to be, you know, we understand that everyone does this, but not Derek Jeter. Not Mr. October. Et tu, Derek. Are there really no heroes anymore?
First.
Say it ain't so, Jeter. Say it ain't so.
First Tiger Woods and now this.
Well, exactly. But it gets much, much better, Andy. Mm. In terms of cheating. Just last week, Bahrain hosted Togo in a friendly. Beating them 3-0. Incredible.
Yep.
Then Togo Soccer Federation said they hadn't actually set their national team and they didn't know who Bahrain had just played. Boom. That is phenomenal. Bahrain's coach complained about the match immediately afterwards, saying the Togo team were not fit enough to play 90 minutes. Allegations quickly sprung up that a fake agent had booked the match and sold it to Bahrain Soccer Federation. Then Togo chimed in, saying, well, yeah, no one told us about a friendly, saying we cannot send our players to play friendly matches abroad without the approval of FIFA. The players that took part in a football match against Bahrain were completely fake. We've not sent any team of footballers to Bahrain. The players are not known to us. And the Togo sports minister says the players belong to a mafia group. That is cheating, Andy.
Your emails now, and thank you for your emails, which this week have included an update on the Rudy Giuliani fundraising campaign for 2008 presidential campaign. Still going strong, John. You can still donate, and I'm sure you regularly do.
Yep.
Also, some exciting drawings of Wangs sent to us as well, including one on the side of a school building. The most notable email this week is from James Allen in Montreal in Canada, who hasn't so much written an email as sent the entire text of Alexander Pope's translation of Homer's Iliad, but with all mentions of Achilles replaced with Andy Zaltzman. And all mentions of the Trojan Prince Hector replaced with John Oliver, culminating, as all Iliad fans will know, in the one man-on-man battle in which Achilles finally kills Hector and drags his corpse around and around the outside of the city walls. Very much what I've done to John's career. So, here it is. It's 400 pages. I mean, I'm not going to recite all of it to you. You know, it would be a long podcast if I did that.
Yeah.
Very long. It begins, Andy Zaltzman's wrath to Greece, the direful spring of woes unnumbered, heavenly goodness, sing. That wrath which held to Pluto's gloomy reign, the souls of mighty chiefs untimely slain. And this goes on for 400 pages of 18th century translation of a probably 9th century BC Greek text.
It's just what both of those writers would have wanted, Andy.
The point is this, John. Thank you, James Allen, for sending this in.
Yes.
This is impressive if, and only if, you have typed this out word for word yourself. I think you might have cut and pasted it and then done a find and replace. Or it'd be even more impressive if you've just taken the original Greek text and come up with the exact same translation as Alexander Pope did almost 300 years ago. So if anyone else has major classical texts they want to send in with our names in...
Careful what you wish for, Andy.
Maybe Virgil's Aeneid with Chris as the eponymous hero, Aeneas, setting about to found the city of Rome. Maybe Aeschylus's Oresteian trilogy with Agamemnon played by Tom Wright. Who knows? Do send them in.
Sport now! And Andy, the shampoo manufacturer Head & Shoulders announced that they are taking out a $1 million insurance policy on Pittsburgh Steelers safety Troy Polamalu's trademark hair. It's going to be protected throughout this NFL season by Lloyd's of London. In fact, they say that Troy's hair is so ridiculously full and thick that end-to-end it spans 100 football fields. There is no way that's true. But then goes on to say, Troy Polamalu says, Head & Shoulders has gone above and beyond by insuring my Samoan locks for a cool $1 million. And he continues, this reinforces that my full and thick hair is unstoppable. Now, Andy, here's the thing. You have quite iconoclastic locks. Is it not time for you to think about taking out a major insurance policy with Lloyd's of London?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I have tried before, and I've always bumped up the premiums because of my hairline.
I see. So that's tough.
Also, he wears a helmet. You know, I guess I'd have to start doing gigs with a helmet on, just to make sure that my hair didn't...
Maybe you should do that with a full NFL helmet with visor. And when are you going to do that? Do it in pads as well.
Yeah, why not?
What do you do? Gigs now dressed up as an NFL linebacker.
I'm going to do gigs as Troy Polamalu. What was that his name?
Yes. Yeah.
I guess to me, John, it seems a bit odd. It seems that American football is the wrong sport to go into if you're concerned about personal grooming.
That's true.
And it, you know, it promotes itself as a hard sport played by hard men, and this slightly undercuts that image. And I would suggest that if you really want a hard sport played by hard men, look at shinty, the ancient Scottish sport, which involves teams of lunatics hitting a hard ball as hard as they can into each other's heads and faces. And you know, the old saying goes, I went to a fight and a game of shinty broke out. In the Ballymore Cup final in July of this year, between the mighty shinty teams of Kinlochshiel and Lochaber, it was 4-4 at the end of a dramatic period of extra time, and it went to a penalty shootout. And the Kinlochshiel goalkeeper was facing up to, and he had to, is the opposition, Lochaber, needed to score to stay in it. And this guy runs up and hits it. It's a small ball, a bit like a hockey ball, I guess. And they hit it with a stick. And the penalty's in taken into a goal like a hockey, like a field hockey goal. And the goalkeeper's standing there with no protection, basically just the stick. And this guy hits the penalty shot hard, John. And he hit it really, really hard. And the goalkeeper, he had a number of choices. He could have put his stick in the way to stop it. He could have maybe tried to stop it with his hands. You know, it was going hard, but that would have been feasible. But he didn't. He's a shinty player, John. He thought either of those would have been a coward's way out. Instead, he headed it. He put his head in the way, and he nutted that ball away before being mobbed by his teammates whilst he staggered around groggily. And if you look it up, if you put Ballymore Cup final into YouTube, and you will see a man heading a hard ball that was moving at about 90 miles an hour.
You know,
just with his dunk with his forehead.
That's why these players are paid the multi-millions, Andy.
the thing is, John, I think he could have not used his head. It was an active choice to use his head.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, good for him.
That's what true courage is, when you have the choice whether to do it or
maybe
not.
Maybe we should start a Bugle Hall of Fame for sport, Andy.
Yep.
And, you know, maybe he should be the first inductee. Well, he wouldn't be the first, because Plaxico Burress and Ocho Cinco are already in there. Not to mention Delonte Webb. Maybe we should do that. Every now and then we should have an inductee to the Bugle Sports Hall of Fame, Andy. Yeah. I think this goalie should go in there.
But he's in. This, I was trying to find out his name, and I looked up on the internet through a search engine, and I found a couple of match reports.
Yeah.
And this is how hard Shinji is as a sport. All it says is that Kinloch Shield won the shootout 2-0. This is not a surprise occurrence. I do not see it fit to mention the fact that the goalkeeper nutted a hard ball moving at 100 miles an hour.
I think if you want to know his name, you might need to check the nearby hospital records from later that evening.
I think it might be Graham Kennedy, I think.
Graham Kennedy.
Graham.
Congratulations, Graham. Yeah. You are in the Bugle Sports Hall of Fame.
Of course, other sportsmen have insured bits of their bodies. The ice hockey goaltender Dominic Hatchek had his testicles insured for $3 million. He believed they had magic psychological powers, and that if he jiggled them whilst an opponent was lining up a slap shot, their subliminal vibes would cause the puck to wobble and fly off target. He also planned to put himself out to stud at the Czech Institute of Ice Hockey Breeding outside Bratislava. Steve Redgrave, the Euro extraordinaire, had his buttocks insured for £1.2 million. Uh-huh. He had hollow buns, John, and they gave his boats extra buoyancy, and if they'd ever been punctured by sitting on a splintery wooden bench whilst eating his trademark high-carb potato, pasta and squirrel sandwiches, or maybe being groped by a long-fingernailed sprint sensation Flojo in an Olympic disco, or having a picture hammered into him by an inattentive workman, well, his career would have been over, so he insured the buttocks. And the 1950s baseball player Sleasdale Pithklotch, who began his career as the third baseman for the Kansas City Tits, insured his nose for $5 million. Pithklotch famously pioneered the now outlawed nose bump stroke, in which he would allow the ball to hit him full on the conch before collapsing at the plate in agony. Opposition players would inevitably, what with it being the 1950s, a more gentlemanly era, gather around in concern whilst any teammates who were on base scuttled round for a home run. His nose, which had begun Pithklotch's career as a proudly Roman protuberance, became gradually flattened, then eventually fully concave until whilst playing for the Pittsburgh Urinals against the Tennessee Tummy Rumblers in a postseason game, a fastball from the ace pitcher Tallyhoo McStain lodged irretrievably in his face, allowing Pithklotch to sprint around the diamond whilst the Tummy Rumblers fielders tried to forcibly excavate the ball from his head. Pithklotch finally stumbled around to home plate with a pitcher, a catcher and four outfielders furiously digging away at his face with hands, gloves and trowels in an unsuccessful attempt to free the ball. Pithklotch thus registered the first and last inside-the-face home run in MLB history, and throughout the rest of his pro career, unremarkably with various franchises including the Houston Hogties, the San Remo Dog Catapults, the Des Moines Boings, the New York Arsonists, Miami Grown, and the Detroit Dickwads. The MLB closed a loophole in the laws that designated the nose as part of the bat, which had been brought in specifically to allow legendary pitcher Cy Young to ping the ball into batters' faces whenever he wanted. Well, I'm done for the day there, John.
Well, that's it.
Yep.
That's it, Buglers.
Do keep your emails coming into thebugle@timesonline.co.uk. And do follow the Bugle Twitter feed @HelloBuglers. Now, well over 8,000 followers, John. That's
good.
That's, I think, more than anyone else in the world, isn't it, Chris? All right.
Just about. Ahead of Gaga.
Yep.
More or less.
Yep.
So, have a lovely week, Buglers.
Yep.
Have fun.
Have a brilliant week.
Yeah, have a really good week.
I hope it's the best week you've ever had.
Yeah,
I hope it's the best week you will ever have.
Those are two very different wishes, Andy. Have a good week. That's the point.
Okay.
Bye!